Well, with very deep cuts now slated for Australia's aid budget, our aid relationship with the rest of the world is set to change in ways we really don't know yet. One of the ways we give, though, as individuals overseas is by volunteering in other countries. Perhaps you've come back from a holiday in Cambodia or Rwanda or Bolivia and thought, I've just got to go back. I've got to help in some way. Perhaps you've done that. Perhaps you've packed up your life here and headed off for an adventure. It's exciting, it's life-changing, it's rewarding. It's not without its challenges, though, for both the volunteer but also for the communities you might volunteer in. This is an exchange, a conversation. Joining me now is the CEO of Australia's Volunteers International, Australian Volunteers International, or AVI, Dimity Pfeiffer, who after years of experience as the head of AVI has come up with a set of founding principles she'd like to share to help Australians work more effectively internationally. She's speaking at Macquarie University to students as part of their PACE public lecture series next Wednesday. And also joining us this morning is Adam Perkins, a father of three. He's a food technician. He swapped the corporate world for a lecturing post. He'd never been a teacher at an ag college in Malawi. Welcome to you both.
Hi there, Natasha.
Good morning, Natasha.
Adam, I'll come to you in a tick. I'll start with you, Dimity. AusAid is a major partner of the Australian Volunteers for International Development Program, which you run. Are you concerned about those deep cuts in terms of the future for your program and for overseas volunteers from Australia?
Natasha, both sides of government historically have been very committed to international volunteering. So I don't see any hiccups, and we've been given no intimation that that will be the case. AVI began its very first volunteer in 1951 with Herb Feith to Indonesia. And then the government of Australia in the early 60s started to appreciate the value of international volunteers for people-to-people links and the development work they were doing alongside communities. And we've had significant support all the way through every single government since then.
Very diplomatic of you, Dimity.
But it's also true, which is fantastic, Natasha. I mean, you talk to anyone in Parliament House, any embassy across the globe, and Australian volunteers are so highly valued that no one would go near that.
So why a set of founding principles from you now?
Okay, well, and I'd perhaps like to call them a set of reflections, Natasha. I mean, you can easily come up with a set of 5, 10 or 20 founding principles, but these are reflections that I've made over the years. And Adam, hi there, Adam, is one of the 10,000 volunteers that we've had here in Australia that have thrown themselves into the lives of communities. And I guess
throwing being the operative word sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you're not trying to tell us what to do here, but you have got some very deep reflections to share about what it means to volunteer.
Sure, and what it means to have an international relationship. So that's what the talk next week's going to be all about. So number one, it's thinking through your current paradigms. I mean, when you pack your bag like Adam and go and volunteer overseas, or it might be an organisation that wants to start an international partnership, you're also packing your own personal and national baggage. And are we, as Australians, prepared to have a little think about the sort of context we grew up with, the sort of paradigms that we bring when we start an international relationship?
What sort of baggage?
Well, the sort of baggage of realising perhaps when you go to Papua New Guinea, just to realise that Papua New Guinea was an Australian territory and that we have got colonial baggage in our history, that when we go overseas, we realise that our languaging is part of our baggage, the way that we use English, the sort of baggage in development speak and in management speak, the sort of baggage that may subtly suggest that West is best and that we're hesitant to spend a good deal of time actually listening to local communities in how they view the world, their vision, their understanding of their own community and the development that they seek, rather than us making assumptions that our way is the right way.
What are the subtle aspects of the West is best thing? Because it's often very unsubtle.
Oh,
but in terms of volunteers heading over...
I know, and it's just fantastic that you got Adam here, who's obviously been through it all. But even the language around development and sustainability, are we prepared to perhaps open up that language and talk about developing and what are the sustaining behaviours we need as people and communities to get us through the challenges that we all face? Are we prepared to understand Ubuntu in Africa, Talanoi in Fiji, the ways that communities have lived for years and appreciated and sustained their own lives, and now they're facing common challenges along with us, whether it be climate change, dealing with how to ensure people with a disability are better integrated into society, aged care. Any number of our volunteers have come back and said they've learnt so much from the communities they've been in and realised that the way that we've been doing things at home isn't necessarily the right way, it is one way, and there are many truths out there.
Mm. So baggage is certainly one of your being cognizant of our baggage, yep, cultural or otherwise, is one of your founding principles. Just give us a couple more and then I'd like to come to Adam.
Well, a few years ago, I went to a fabulous place in England called the Schumacher College. E.F. Schumacher wrote a book called Small is Beautiful a number of years ago.
Very influential.
And it still is. And I've, anytime I have meetings over in Europe or England, I always look up the Schumacher College website to see if there's a short course I can take. This particular course was called After Development, What Next? Was the term development arrived really in 1949 when Truman announced the Marshall Plan. And since then, we've divided up the world into developing and developed countries. And I believe now is the time that we settle some of those phrases to remember that we're all equal partners, we're all equal nations as one global family. And after development, what next? I actually didn't have an idea really where to go with that. But the speakers that came on were Vandana Shiva from India, and Gustavo Estiva from Mexico. And it was Gustavo who said, after development, hospitality. And just all these light bulbs went off in my brain, Natasha.
Bing, 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 bing. That's your brain.
I know.
Sound
it
effects.
Was just,
it's radio.
Well, it was just fantastic. Thank you for that. But it was really about, are we giving and receiving and welcoming people into our communities? And that's what happens with international volunteers. Overseas communities welcome volunteers into their communities, into their culture, into their rich rituals and celebrations, into their homes, their marketplaces. And are we prepared to give and receive and be hospitable rather than development, which says that there is an inequality between nations as the underlying assumption?
Yes, I've always found the expression developing country as if, you know, thousands of years of human heritage have nothing to count for. Quite bizarre myself. Let me come to, I should say, I'm talking to Dimity Pfeiffer, CEO of Australian Volunteers International, who wants to provoke with a set of founding principles for volunteers who are heading overseas to volunteer in all sorts of contexts. And one of those volunteers is Adam Perkins, who I gather was you're a food technician. You've worked in the corporate sphere for many years. You packed up your bag and you headed off to Malawi. Hi, Adam.
Good morning, Natasha. Good morning, Dimity. Yes, I have a very patient wife and family, and when the opportunity arose with AVI, I thought this was a good opportunity to give back. So our personal circumstances, our family circumstances were right. The assignment was of just the length that we could make it work.
6 months, I think, for you. Why did you particularly want to do it?
Oh, look, I think it was a combination of personal and professional challenges. Like I said, I was between jobs, so that helped. I wasn't having to give up a job. But it was more to go and give something back to an area of the world that I badly knew needed some of these skills in the area of food processing and value-added agriculture.
So you took yourself to Malawi with Australian Volunteers International. And what was the posting that you were given?
So the posting that I was given was I was a lecturer in food processing at one of Malawi's largest agricultural colleges, just outside their capital, Lilongwe. It's a college that has about 280 hectares of land. It has a number of research plots. It teaches students and frontline agriculture or extension workers skills to take to the subsistence farming population about improving crop yields, improving their flocks, their herds, in essence, to try and make them more food secure.
You'd never been a teacher before, I gather, although your wife was, I think.
My wife is. She's a teacher in Melbourne. I've done some short courses, but I think, you know, what equipped me, obviously, was my technical training, all those years in multinational food companies. So I felt confident to be able to teach the subject matter. It was more the environment, the teaching environment over there that I found very, very difficult.
Yeah, well, tell us what some of the difficulties were as you were teaching the students things like how to preserve food safely and the principles of food microbiology. What were the challenges for you?
Sure. So I think they were largely in terms of the infrastructure there. So when I arrived in January, classes didn't start for another maybe 4 or 5 weeks. So when I found, I was kind of expecting that there would be lecture notes and teacher resources and audio-visual material that you might expect in a college or a good school back in Melbourne. And there wasn't any of that. So I had to get my skates on that first month and really develop the course from scratch. So that took up a lot of my time. But practically delivering the course over 10 weeks of a 13-week semester, electricity was very intermittent. So there was a lot of chalk and talk. So rather than using PowerPoint presentations, you were writing on a blackboard.
The good old-fashioned way.
That's right.
PowerPoint's tedious.
Yeah, it is.
Well, no, it has its place. But, you know.
So there was intermittent electricity. Running water was often intermittent. So when you're running large practical classes for students, teaching them food processing, cooking techniques, to have the water go off in the middle of a class, you need to be able to think on your feet and be resilient and have a plan B and C and D to make sure you got through your work.
You had a lot of other challenges too, and I guess you're away from your family, which is hard in and of itself. But you also tested yourself in other ways. You tried to live on a dollar a day.
I did, you know. I think Malawi, I'll probably get the figures wrong, but I believe more than half of the country, maybe three quarters of the country, lives on a dollar a day or less. And from William Easterly's work, The White Man's Burden, and you often hear this term thrown away in magazines. So I thought I would just try it for a week and see if I could do it. And I got to kind of day three of that week, and after losing about 3 kilos, found that this was tough. So I just couldn't afford to buy some meats and vegetables and things at a foreigner's rates to get down to that aggregate dollar a day thing. So it meant eating one meal a day if I was to meet or beat that target, and I didn't do it.
It's a big test. Well, in terms of what Dimity's been saying about that cultural exchange and some of the challenges about, you know, breaking down some of your own assumptions about why you're there and what role you have in engaging with a community as a volunteer. Well, what were some of the things that evolved for you? Because I think you have an ongoing relationship now with that college.
Oh, sure. I've made some good solid friends through that assignment. I think the secret to volunteering, I'm sure many other volunteers will have different experiences, but you have to be very resilient and self-reliant. So, very often those support networks or your ability to reach out and make a phone call back home or a Skype or FaceTime, they're just not available to you. So you have to be resilient and be good at contingency planning. You also have to be really flexible and adaptable. So in addition to my teaching responsibilities, I ended up doing some project management work on some other farm activities around the college farm, like setting up some systems to project manage some other European aid projects.
We're just losing you. Just adjust the headset a bit for us.
So talking to some of the other college staff members about project management skills and just helping them with general everyday life, because it is a real struggle for them.
What did they give you?
Oh, look, they gave me warmth and they were very welcoming. Malawi is often referred to as the warm heart of Africa, so they integrated me into their families and their communities. Often I was invited around for dinner, or I didn't have a television where I stayed, so one of the other academics had some cable television, and I'd often go and watch some soccer at his place. So they were very warm and welcoming and just made me feel part of their family, their community.
It's fantastic, Adam. Dimity Pfeiffer, finally to you, and there's so much more to talk about here, but for you, what is the measure of success for your volunteer, for you when you're placing volunteers through the organisation around the world?
And I think Adam expressed that just so beautifully. When we choose volunteers, we, you know, we look for people, you know, who they are, how they work, not just what they do. So for us, the most respectful thing a volunteer can do is to complete their assignment in conjunction and alongside their employing organisation overseas and work closely with them. Also, the other measures of success are, as Adam said, that he's welcomed into people's homes, that he's got long-term relationships, that he has found that a transformative experience with a deeper understanding on both sides for Malawi about Australians and Australians, because I'm sure Adam talks about it to everyone he knows about Malawi. And, I mean, I myself have found that, you know, I've sat in refugee camps in the Middle East, and I've had women in their 70s just hug me and say, Dimity, you know, the work of your volunteers transformed aged care here or disability services. However, the thing that really meant the most to us was the fact that an Australian was willing to give up their lifestyle in Australia for 2 years and come and live amongst us and live the life alongside us 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And it's those hugs, those smiles, those thank yous that you know that development is more than just, you know, the charts, the statistics. It's about that hospitality, the fact that lives have been changed and we've created impact and made change a reality right across the world.
Yes, indeed. And well, and it's a big commitment, but it's, and I was intrigued by the kind of interrogation the families get. Because, Adam, even though your wife didn't come, she got your family setting got scrutinised as to whether you'd be robust enough.
Look, I think that's really important for volunteers, and I think it's a really good part of the ABI process, because you do go away, and the fact that I was able to go away, albeit for a short time of 6 months, it puts a lot of strain on your family back home. So my wife had to hold the fort for that period of 6 months and get the kids to school and do all the stuff that I might normally be around to help with. So, excuse me, the recruitment process, I found that ABI was very thorough, it was rigorous. It took prospective volunteers through cultural training, safety, security, cross-cultural awareness, so you really knew what you were getting in for. It was a very, very thorough process.
But then I think the family came and joined you in Malawi at the end of it all anyway.
They did. That was a bit of a treat for the family at the end. So they came across and saw what sort of conditions I was living in, and got to meet some of my kind of extended family in Malawi, so That was great, especially for my three daughters.
Oh, look, I love how you describe your family in Malawi as your extended family. I thank you both for joining us this morning, Dimity Pfeiffer and Adam Perkins. Thank you indeed.
Pleasure,
thank
Natasha.
You, thank you, Natasha.
Thanks.
And
bye.
Dimity Pfeiffer
bye
is...
Bye, Adam.
Dimity's CEO of the Australian Volunteers International. Put details about them on our website, Life Matters website, and Adam Perkins, a volunteer, a food technician. Clearly got oodles out of it, and I gather he's involved in setting up a small scholarship scheme now for agricultural students, and he often sends them books because he knows the need at the college. So aid reaching out globally happens in so many more ways, and often at the level of the individual. Perhaps you've had an experience that was transformative for you or for a community that you lived within. Love to hear from you. We often do, actually, hear from listeners who have had those experiences overseas.